Subscribe to Simply Bitcoin.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Welcome into another episode of the Meme Factory podcast. This is test stream number 21 with Mark Moss. There will never be a real stream, only ever test streams, because we're still in production here. Mark, could you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about what it is you do in the Bitcoin space.
Yeah, so I've been making content in the Bitcoin space for maybe, I don't know, 6 years. Make a couple YouTube videos a week. I think I got 10 million views last year on that. Not too bad. Podcast, and I'm the first nationally syndicated radio show host. So October, I launched a nationally syndicated radio show on Bitcoin that's on the iHeartRadio network, and speak around the country at a couple big events. I'm looking forward to speaking at Bitcoin conference, and you know, talking crap on a podcast with friends like you.
Heck yeah, we appreciate you coming on tonight, man. It's definitely an honor having you. You're a great voice to pay attention to in the Bitcoin space. And congratulations on the national syndication. That's the first Bitcoin?
Yeah, the first Bitcoin, the first crypto. But I mean, I'm Bitcoin, not crypto, but the first at all crypto, Bitcoin, whatever. The iHeartRadio network is the largest radio network in the United States. And then it's nationally syndicated, which means that other stations are independently owned, but they syndicate through that. And they're super excited about it. It's growing super fast, and they love it, and they want to double down on it. And so that's super encouraging.
That's awesome.
So for us euros, what did that exactly mean? Like, they're gonna take the— can you explain it a little bit?
Yeah, well, so for— I would imagine it's probably very similar in Europe. I don't know, but I mean, you have the radio. So obviously, you know, before streaming music, you listen to stuff on the radio, which seems like it's a dying trend, but it's still pretty big. Like, people still listen to the radio all over. So it's radio stations, right? And so, you know, you change the dial on the radio and there's like different stations. And so each one of those are owned and operated by different people, but they'll syndicate it out, meaning that all these different stations will pick it up. So I think right now, I mean, the show's only been up for a couple months now, but I think we're in like 24 different markets, and I don't know how many stations that is, but it's a bunch. You know, it's growing faster and faster. So all the different radio stations, right? So on the dial, you have everything from, I don't even know what, 90, 88 to 107 or something like that. So each one of those is like a different station that's each independently owned and operated. And then each market, like every city, every state would have like its own station. And so— yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Sure. Awesome, man.
Okay. So yeah, I know. Yeah. What's that, Mark?
Yeah. So they picked up the podcast. So I've had my YouTube show and the podcast going for a couple of years now. They picked up the podcast, put that on the iHeartRadio network, or the iHeartPodcast network. I got the radio show. And then, yeah, it's just trying to bring as many people into the Bitcoin space as we can.
You are one of the hardest working guys in Bitcoin.
I am. I've been working my butt off. I'm working on a big book. Well, I don't know about the hardest, but I got a big book I'm trying to get out this summer. Last week, which this is under wraps, you guys are kind of the first to know, me and Alex Fetsky got together and spent 5 days holed up in a Airbnb in Austin, Texas with a bunch of coffee and wrote a book.
Wow.
That's going to be popping out here in the next week or so. Yeah, just trying to put out as much content as we can. I have an urgency. Like you listen to the podcast with Peter McCormick, the battle for the fate of humanity. Like, that's literally how serious that I approach this. We have a couple years to like win this thing. And I can't rest until, you know, we get on the other side of that.
All right. Before we launch into less than serious stuff, I want to make sure that we get this going. We're a small podcast. We get most of our revenue from the podcast comes from ads. I'm sure you're familiar with that business model.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So one of the ways that we're able to bring in millions of dollars weekly is
nice.
That we have our sponsors send us ad copy that we tell them the guest is going to read. So if you could check your Twitter DMs, I've sent you this week's ad copy. Just need you to run through it real quick.
Yeah, just don't think about it.
Yeah, don't think about it.
If there's no conflict, I don't know. Let's see.
I'm sure there won't be.
But are you guys making money out of this?
No.
What's this millions of dollars?
Nobody was supposed to tell Mike about the micro about the money.
He doesn't speak English. You're good.
All right.
Oh, we mean potatoes, Mike.
Okay, I think I can do this one.
Doesn't conflict with anything?
No, I don't have any conflicting sponsors on this one. So
excellent.
Bonus.
Yeah. All right. So should I do it?
Let's go.
At your pleasure.
Are you recording? Everyone's paying attention? Okay, we're live. Right, is this thing on?
It's like, yeah, we're going out across the nation.
All right, here we go. You want to see a pro in action?
We do.
Hey, everyone. Mark Moss here. This episode of the Meme Factory podcast is brought to you by the Pen and Paper Foundation, helping to eradicate pen and paper suffering worldwide since 1743. Have you ever noticed the systematic oppression of the world's second favorite writing implement and its partner, the paper? Well, let me elucidate you. Sorry, that's a big word for me. Let me elucidate you. What's the difference between a pen and a life? Well, pen has a point. I asked my pen why it never moves, and it wrote, "Sorry, I'm stationary." Now, what did the dog say after walking over a piece of sandpaper? Rough, rough. These jokes are harmful and discriminatory towards an entire set of analog informational tools. These jokes sow the seeds of disharmony and are a major driving factor in the disparity in use between analog information tools and digital ones. Join us and join me in stopping the hate today. Make a donation to the Pen and Paper Foundation by writing a check and mailing it to the Pen and Paper Foundation, 615 Hodler Drive, Scranton, PA.
Whoop, whoop.
Sincerely, the Meme Factory.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Now you know why the sponsors pay me the big bucks.
Exactly. And just checking now. Looks like our payment will get confirmed on the main chain pretty soon there. Thank you.
And then Yellow will send me some more sats.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Just don't tell Micro Chad.
Here. Micro, those are potatoes, man.
Really, it's Labber we gotta worry about when giving out sats.
Mark,
whatever.
One of the things I really appreciate about your content is that a lot of it centers around entrepreneurship. And it's not just talk. I get to see you enact what you're talking about. How have you made the way you do business fit with Bitcoin? Like, where's the overlap there?
Well, the overlap is that I think Bitcoin has a thread that basically weaves everywhere through society. And it intersects all our lives differently. So you have some people that are super into the technical side, or some people that are into the data side, the on-chain side, or some people that are more of a political side or philosophical side, you know, so everybody, it kind of hits them a little bit differently. I think for me, I mean, it's kind of more in the political / historical kind of sense. That's kind of where I find my interest in Bitcoin. If you're asking how I've been able to hit, how it intersects on a business side, like how I've been able to make a business out of Bitcoin, is that what you're asking?
No, more along the lines of where has Bitcoin kind of infiltrated your philosophy in approaching a business? So like, I know that the 2008 financial crisis had a tough impact on you.
Sure.
And I think it's made you anti-fragile as a result.
Yeah. Yeah. So in regards to that, I mean, I grew up in Southern California. I'm an extreme sports athlete. I tried to chase a pro snowboarding career. I grew up racing dirt bikes. And so I've broken all my bones. I have metal in all four limbs of my body. And that's made me anti-fragile. I'm screwed back together. I'm pretty good there. And I'm used to just like, I got my bones screwed back together. Like, let me just try that again. So I think that's a lot of it. To your point though, I mean, 2008 sucked. I had done really well. I learned how to make a lot of money. I was pretty good at that. I didn't figure out the keeping the money part. And so 2008, I got wiped out like everybody else. And it was mostly because I knew how to make money, but I didn't understand that there was all these factors outside of my control in this financial system, like this financial casino, as I like to call it. And these bankers had run away, you know, betting the whole world and lost it all. And that affected me in my life and wiped me out. And so I wasn't cool with that. I was like, well, I got to figure this out. I got the making money part, but what the heck is this whole thing over here? So I spent a lot of time figuring it out. I very quickly became a gold bug. I was like, okay, the problem is the Federal Reserve and the unlimited money supply. That's the problem. And we need to go back to sound money and gold. We need to go back to gold, right? And so I became a gold bug. And now I just found out that I'm a sound money advocate. And so I think Bitcoin is a better version of that, right? It's a better way to get that sound money. But I think in my Twitter profile, it says I'm a sound money advocate. And so I kind of went from a gold bug to a sound money advocate. It made me anti-fragile. I think about, you know, the cliche, it's not a cliche, but you know, the Mike Tyson thing about everyone's got a plan till they get punched in the face. And a lot of people today haven't been punched in the face. You know, I got started in my real estate career right out of high school. Right when I was 18, I started buying properties that were bank owned. And the reason why the bank owned lots of properties is because we just went through this massive bear market, this real estate crash. And then I invested, I got my investing career started coming out of that. And then I was investing through the dot-com run up. I remember my roommate quit his job at the time and he was trading these crazy things called internet stocks. It was a wild time back then. We're talking about all these internet stocks and people are just like, what are you guys talking about? Kind of like crypto, you know? And then that market crashed on me. And then I started another business at the bottom of that bear market. And so, you know, I've been punched in the face a couple of times, but to your point, yeah, I mean, it definitely makes you anti-fragile. I like to think of the saying, smooth seas never made a skilled sailor, right? And so I've been through it, but also the perspective. So like when I first really started getting into Bitcoin, if I rewind back at the bottom of the dot-com crash in 2001, I started this e-commerce business and it wasn't easy to start a website back then. There was no Shopify. Had to hire someone to build it custom. And I went to these companies, I was in the motocross industry, and I said, hey, I want to sell your products on my website. And I had businesses literally laugh at me and tell me no one would ever buy anything online. That was ridiculous. And I'm like, well, I think they will. And I've spent all this money on this website and I'm happy to just buy your products and sell them. And it's on me if it doesn't sell. And people actually said, no, we don't want our stuff being sold on the internet. Wow. And so that perspective helped me kind of, you know, as Bitcoin's coming around, I have all the people saying it's never going to work. And I'm like, yeah, I've been there before. I've heard that one.
So that backstory perfectly can like go to what Bitcoin is and how especially Saylor describes is that digital property. Like, what do you see in that section? What inspires you or like you're really excited about?
Well, I think when I think of digital property, I like to think of it as a bigger, so a lot of times people really focus too small down. I like to think of digital property as something bigger. And so, you know, property starts with my own personal body and then extends out to where I've expended energy to acquire resources. So whether that's my house, my food, my businesses, et cetera. And so as far as digital property goes, I think, you know, Bitcoin has solved the oldest problem that man has had, which is how do I secure my property in a way that it can't be stolen from me? And so when I think about it in terms like that, it's the oldest problem that mankind has suffered from the beginning. Two guys in the world, you're going to come steal my chickens or my goats, right? And how do I secure that property? And so I think Bitcoin has solved that, and not just the ability for me to, you know, protect that property without it being stolen, but also the ability to move that property. And so I think those two things in regards to property kind of gives it some, you know, some good properties that I like.
I'm talking about walking with your property. You recently moved to Puerto Rico, right?
I moved to Puerto Rico last year and I just moved back a few weeks ago. So January of 2021, I moved over to Puerto Rico. California was trying to compete with New York to see who could be the strictest in the nation on lockdowns. So the whole state was locked down. The schools were shut down. And I had been looking at Puerto Rico for a long time. I'm a surfer. So I'm like, dang, if I could go live in the Caribbean and have awesome waves and weather, and I could pay almost no taxes, and they were more open than California was at the time, I was like, great, let's do it. So I went and spent the year there. I'd never really moved before. So it was pretty difficult moving for the first time. But after a few months, I kind of got into it. I met a couple good buddies over there. A lot of people, it's kind of this gulch. A lot of investors and marketing people have moved over there for the same reasons. And so there's a lot of good people to network with and a lot of networking stuff going on. But the final nail in the coffin is that in August of last year, basically they've gone way more COVID crazy than even anywhere in the United States has. And they put a whole island-wide mandate in effect. But even though it was in effect where I was on my side of the island, they weren't really enforcing it. So like you could kind of like no one really cared about it. But in December, it was like, nope, that's it. Crack down. Everybody show your papers to gain access to society. And so I'm out. I ain't playing that game. So we left.
Back to California or somewhere else?
Yeah, I'm back in California right now. I mean, what's crazy is in Los Angeles, it's a hellhole. I mean, it's like homeless people all over where it's everywhere. I mean, it's unbelievable how bad it is. It's worse than a movie. Like you guys have probably seen the train with all the trash down the tracks. I mean, that's literally what LA looks like. I was up there 2 weeks ago. I tried to go to a Burger King just to go to the bathroom, and you can't even go in the Burger King without showing your papers. I'm in the next county now.
In California.
Yeah, California.
Unpack that. So in LA, you can't go into a Burger King without showing vax papers?
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't know. Okay, no.
Yeah, you can't go anywhere. You can't go anywhere in LA without that. No restaurants, no whatever, right? But I'm in the next county over, and no masks, no mandates, nobody gives a damn. And so it's cool.
It's county by county in California, right?
It's county by county, yeah. So it's, the governor is trying to get as, tyrannical as he possibly can be, but the counties, are still fighting it and pushing back. And so we have a good sheriff here in a good county, and they've just said, we ain't doing none of that. And so it's California, but it's not as crazy as San Francisco and Los Angeles are out of their minds. But just like I said, the next county over, it's pretty normal. But as I said, I was just in Austin, Texas last week. I spent the week there, and I just closed on a 12 and a half acre ranch about 30 minutes outside of Austin. I got cows and goats and chickens and donkeys now. Nice. And
taking care of all those animals. You have a farmhand?
We're hiring a ranch hand.
You need a job, Sean?
All those animals. Yeah.
What?
You need a job, Sean?
Yeah. I'll be back in the summer. So,
are you a ranch hand?
No. I have a buddy who has.
He's a ranch hand. So. He's a ranch hand.
Okay.
He'd be fine.
So, we're trying to hire a ranch hand to take care of all those animals, and that's kind of like our plan B. So, like Austin's kind of Bitcoin capital of the world. I love what's going on there. So, we'll go spend a little bit of time there. If California gets too crazy, then we'll escape to the ranch. That's kind of my backup plan.
You talking with Modern T-Man out there or Untapped Growth about the ranch?
Untapped quite a bit, yeah. I held a live conference on top of all those other things I do. I've been running a live event. I started called Market Disruptors Live. I did one in November in Miami, and Untapped came and spoke at the event. And so, yeah, he's a friend, and I talked to him. He's up in – he's not in Texas. He's up north. I'm not going to dox that, but he's definitely someone I talk to and try to get a little bit of information from. I don't know anything about, I'm a surfer guy from the beach in California. I don't know anything about managing animals.
Mark, the secret is poop.
What do you do with it?
Just like spray it around the ground. It will do the trick.
Yeah.
Trust me.
So the property is set up with these different fences. So then you move the cows from one section to the next. So they poop and eat the grass in one section. Then you move them to the next section. And I guess the poop makes the grass grow again, apparently.
Yeah. Well, they're roaming animals, right? So it's not like you stick them on a field and just leave them and harvest the meat. You have to move them around and they trample the earth. And yeah, it's amazing, actually. Listening to Modern T-Man and Untapped Growth, it's completely changed my outlook on the whole deforestation question as well. And actually, the fact that forests are effectively carbon temporary storage units, but grasslands are permanent ones.
Yeah.
And so if you're raising cattle, you're burying that carbon into the, anyone that buys into the whole CO2 thing, it completely tangential, I know, sorry guys, but this is what the narrative is, right? But there's such a phenomenal positive story that comes out of natural grazing and raising of ruminants. It's incredible, actually, and it's a fucking crime that this stuff is being frowned upon now and talked about negatively. So great. It's great that you're doing that. And this is how it starts at the local level. And guys like you that have had success that can go about building your own little citadels and getting your farmlands going. This is how we fucking win.
Yeah. And I like it. I like Austin area because one, it's Bitcoin capital, but two, outside of town where I'm at, I know about six other people who have bought 10 to 20 acre ranches within probably about a 20 minute radius from where I'm at. And they're all working together. So the community has like come together and all these ranches are kind of working together and not just working together amongst themselves, but even working together with the local sheriff, law enforcement and government, set up militias. And like, dude, nobody wants to mess with that location. Like everybody's gun toting, freedom loving, steak eating, working with local law enforcement. Like it's an amazing place to be, a good community to be in. And to your point, yeah, that's the way, right? Start local and then kind of branch out from there.
So exactly. The vax papers will be mandatory on your ranch and out there.
I am playing that game. Like I said, I really started to like it over in Puerto Rico and my buddies over there, they're like, you know, just get the papers and you can just whatever. I'm like, no, like I'm not playing that game because I believe the only way this wins, right? The whole world is trending towards totalitarianism and technology is making it very easy for these guys to do that. And I think that my opinion, the only way that we break that trend of totalitarianism isn't through some shooting war, some hot war, it's through competition. Right. And so people will start moving to places that aren't as restrictive. We'll vote with our feet, we'll vote with our money. And that's what's going to turn the tides. And so it has to start with me. I have to set the example for myself and for my family and for my friends. And then hopefully it just keeps going from there.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It is interesting because I'm out in Spain right now and I had to show some vax papers the other day. I was at a restaurant. And I was already sitting down and then the guy came and the waiter came and asked me for my papers. I was like, I don't have any papers. And then another waitress came by and she was like, oh, that's fine. You know? So it's like, sometimes they're like, they'll harp you, but if you're just like, I don't have any, then you just never know what's going to happen. But it was a really weird feeling when he was about to just kick me right out of the restaurant just because I couldn't show any vaccine papers, which I'd never had before.
And then you got up, like you just stand, and he left you alone.
Yeah, that was good what happened. Stood up, looked down on him.
He's like, oh, never mind.
Yeah, man, it's weird how the totalitarianism, populism, decentralization, it all kind of like swings in cycles, right, Mark? I know you've been talking about that.
Yeah, that's something I spent a lot of time on. You know, history is, for whatever reason, is just the one subject I liked out of school. And I just find it fascinating. Like the more things change, the more they're just actually staying the same. And I think like everything, I think when you zoom out in Bitcoin, we always say like zoom out, like people are like, oh, Bitcoin crashed all the way to 40,000. It's like, well, zoom out. Like we're still doing really good. Right. And it's that perspective. Like when I tell my kids like, hey, don't do that, it's dangerous. They don't understand that because they don't have my zoomed out perspective. Right. And so I think when you look at through a short-term lens of like, well, what's happening right now, like populist uprising, you know, all over the world, people are pushing back, but it's random, right? I mean, this was a black swan event. Like nobody could have known this, right? Like I mean, who would have known they would be pushing back against mandates because of a virus? Well, if you zoom out, you'd see actually no, this isn't random at all. As a matter of fact, this is happening right on cue.
Yeah.
About every 84 years, we have a populist uprising, regime change that happens every 84 years. And so 84 years ago was the end of World War II, Hitler, Mussolini in the U.S. We had FDR's New Deal that, you know, changed the U.S. from a kind of a capitalist society to a socialist country. 84 years before that was the Communist Manifesto, which led to the European Spring, the largest revolution in history. And so we see that repeating. And then every 84 times 3 is 252. And so every 250 years, we have this revolution cycle. And so every 250 years, we have 250 years ago was the American and the French Revolution. 250 years before that was the Protestant Reformation. And those were pushing back on centralization and setting up decentralization. So the US was pushing back on the centralization of the monarchy and set up a decentralized, set up a republic, right? A decentralized government. And so while this looks super random, you would actually see that no, we're peaking out. The pendulum is full tilt at centralization or globalization. And it's easy to see that. World Economic Forum, World Trade Organization, Health Organization, UN, IMF, et cetera. So we're peaking out and the people are pushing back. They're rejecting it. They don't want it anymore. And now the pendulum is about to start swinging back onto another arc back to decentralization. And so, yeah, I think when you see it from that, you see it happening over and over. It's not random.
So here's a question I have, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. To what extent have they anticipated this? And I guess you'll know they what who? I mean by they. Or, sorry?
I was who's they?
Yeah, who's they?
Who is they? Well,
Illuminati.
Let's say
is that just their preferred pronoun?
Who ordained on themselves the role of the great narrators, right? You see people like Klaus Schwab pivoting now from the Great Reset, which is obviously getting a lot of attention, a lot of heat. The fact checkers are on it. Trying to debunk it and naysay it, and actually he himself is now switching to the great narrative. And I'm not pinning all of this on Klaus Schwab. I think he's a tool in the box. He's owned by somebody else.
There it is.
But I got his name. I got his name on the book. Right. It's pretty hard to distance himself when his name's on the book.
Yeah. I still think he's owned, but either way,
yeah.
You know what he's pivoting to now, and he has a lot of influence over a lot of major corporations, right? I don't doubt his influence and the people that back him, because I see the way in which a lot of the things that he says actually are being propagated out into the corporate realm, and then subsequently the media, and then the public realm as well. So I think we underestimate that guy at our peril. But you know, he's now talking about the great narrative, and one of the things that he says is that big cultural shifts don't happen by accident. The thing that catalyzes them is that there is a shift in the story. That people are en masse led to believe in something, in inverted marks, in something better, right? In a story that they buy into. And I think a lot of this, we've seen how a lot of people have been galvanized around how they are heroic in wearing their fucking masks and bending the knee to the whole yeah. COVID hysteria, etc. And so you know, you talk about, or you mentioned that we now have mobility, international mobility. We certainly had a lot of that before COVID, and there seems to be some evidence of that coming back. But I don't think any of us can deny that there are choke points that we're all susceptible to, right? If we don't have super levels yeah. of wealth. And so I kind of wonder how... how we defend against this, and how this how am I trying to put this? How do you see this playing out, really? In you know, when you have people like Klaus Schwab who are trying to move society's values from valuing freedom to valuing effectively anything that technocrats say.
Yeah.
How does this play out, Mark?
There's a couple ways that plays out, shorter and longer time frame. So the first thing I would say is just tackling what you said that he said, which is it's really the stories, the narratives that shift.
Yeah.
You know, I don't necessarily agree with that. So when you look back again through the long lens of history, it, what changes the world are mega political factors. These are technological shifts in the way that humanity works and organizes itself. So back to, if we just look at Klaus Schwab, for example, or the WF or whatever name you want to put on it, they, them. If you look back at the Protestant Reformation, which I referenced, coming out of the Roman Republic, which was one of the best governments ever, then we had the empire and then it collapsed. And then we had the Dark Ages. The barbarians came in and destroyed everything. I'm just kind of fast forwarding through history. And what happened is history was, the world was really messy. The church kind of came in, organized it, but after 500 years became super corrupted. And the church and state, you know, controlled everything. And the people had no other option. And they had this chivalry and they had all these codes they had to do, right? And the church basically had a stranglehold on everybody. But about 70 years before, a technology was invented called the printing press, and it decentralized the information. And once the people were able to get the information and read it for themselves, the church lost a lot of their power. And if anybody were to read the Bible or say what the Bible said in it, or had any ideas other than what the church said, it was called heresy. They were labeled heretics and they were put to death. They were killed, and probably millions of people were killed. The church tried everything they could do to try to keep a handle on that situation, but they couldn't. It didn't matter. It was too strong a movement. And so one, I would say that that's very similar to where we're today, right? So they have this narrative. If you don't toe the line, if you say anything that they don't want, they will assassinate you, at least online, right? They'll deplatform you, et cetera. But the problem is, no matter how hard they try, they can't, like, the truth out there. Like, we know, like, Joe Rogan's getting 200 million views. Like, they're getting 50,000 views on their CNN shows. Like, so they're going to keep trying, but I believe just like the church, they'll lose their grip. But there's more to it as well. So what happened is after the church lost their grip, we had this burst of information, right? And it led to the Renaissance age. So now people could think and speak clearly and freely. And then we had this burst of information, education, and trade opened up. We had sound money, the florin, the longest lasting coin that wasn't debased, about 300-400 years. And then what happened is it led to science and technology, and the Industrial Revolution happened. And now we had machines that could work for people. It was amazing. But that was a big shift. So that was 250 years later. Notice the time frames. So about 250 years after, so 1500 marks the Protestant Reformation, 1770s equals the Industrial Revolution. And so then we started building machines, we started building factories. And so everybody came decentralized from the farms and the cottage industries into the cities. And then it started centralized. So we started building big businesses and big factories and big plants. And if you wanted to make any money, you had to go to the country that had that industrialization, the United States or Western Europe, and then you had to live in one of the big cities. So we had all these big cities started. So all this centralization happened for the last 250 years. And it made it very easy for the governments to just squeeze that. Like if you owned a local bakery in, you know, downtown and the mob wanted to come extort you, you can't just move, right? You have to pay their protection. And the government was able to do that because everybody was centralized. But what's happening is now the pendulum is swinging back the other way. And so people are leaving the cities to go live out on the ranch or on the farm. People are leaving America to go live in Mexico, Central America, et cetera. And so that's the trend. People are starting to disperse. Technology is changing the way that the world organizes and groups itself. The internet has decentralized the information just like the printing press did. And so just like the church lost its stranglehold from 1500 for the next 250 years, that's what's going to happen. And no matter what Klaus Schwab does, no matter what those guys do, it's just too strong of a trend. I don't think they can stop it. That's the big picture.
What about this cyber polygon threat, this cyber threat that they seem to be trying to socialize and threaten? You've got a background in tech. What's your perspective on the viability of this, and do you have any thoughts on where it might happen?
So what I was saying, that's the big trend. On a shorter trend, how do we navigate this on the short term? So we have threats of cyber attacks, of course. They're trying to change the narrative on this and all these types of things. So I think the one thing is we have to continue to be vigilant on sharing information. That's what breaks. It's always education information that breaks their grip, just like the Protestant Reformation. The quote that I'm building a new office right now, I'm moving into next week, and I have a big quote on the wall, and it's Samuel Adams, and it says, "It doesn't take a majority to prevail, but rather a small, irate minority that continues to light brush fires in the minds of men." And that's all we have to keep doing, right? As long as we're doing that, that's what will break the trend. So we have to be irate and tireless on that. And then we have to help people kind of through these types of psyops, if you will, right? So right now they're posturing that there's another war. So at the end of an 80-year long-term debt cycle, the financial system is ready to be reset. Not only do we know that because of history, not only do we know that because of where the debt and the interest rates are, but we also know that because the IMF called for a Bretton Woods 2 moment.
Yeah.
What does that mean, right? So when there's a financial system ready to be reset, the best way to cover that is with war. Every war we've had has been after a financial collapse. And so how do we cover up this reset? Well, we have a war. Well, war on what? Well, we can go to war with Russia or China. I don't think that's going to happen. It's more like a war on COVID. It's a war on the cyber pandemic, or it's a war on climate. Wait for it. So I think those are psyops that they're going to run for us. But back to the point specifically, they're definitely posturing and positioning in the news. They started running their, you know, events, their tests on what this cyber pandemic would look like, how they would handle it, just like they did before the pandemic broke out. And then I think just yesterday or day before, CISA, the Cyber Intelligence Security Agency, put out an alert alerting people that there could be a cyber attack. Of course, they've been painting Russia for the last couple of years as being the biggest, you know, meddler in the US. And so they're definitely setting the stage for it. I guess one, we can help overcome that by kind of seeing through their plans. I think two, we need to understand how they would do it. So just like they kind of game planned out the pandemic and it basically played out exactly like they said it did, they've also game planned this, and I've read the playbook and everybody else should as well, but I'll give you the highlights if you want.
Yes.
Basically what they said is that it would be an attack against the financial system. Mm. And what they would do is it would create panics in the market. And
it jam the printer button onto print.
Well, no, actually what they said is because it would create panic in the market as the financial system would come under attack. And what they would need to do, it's a playbook they've done multiple times before, they would go on a bank holiday. That means shut the banks down. That means no money out, no transactions, no nothing. They shut the banks. That's what they did in 1933 when they seized the gold, actually 6102. They shut the banks down. They give it a week or two. See what they want to do. When you open it up back up, like in Cyprus, you end up with about half the money you had before, right, or something like that.
Yeah.
And so what they can do is blame it on a cyber attack.
Yeah.
You and I won't ever know the difference.
Yeah.
It's like it's a bail-in, but they blame it on a cyber attack.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's perfect cover. They've been setting the stage. They've been sowing the seeds. Everybody's afraid. They've game planned it. And it goes just like this one did. And it's a perfect cover for their story. We just have to figure out how do we protect ourselves from that. So the first one is, of course, Bitcoin. We don't have our money in the bank. So go ahead, shut the banks down for a week, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, when they reopen the banks, they're going to reprice Bitcoin higher in dollar terms, right?
You know, I mean, it's funny, but it's not that funny because realistically, I mean, you know, we're in Bitcoin. Yeah, sure. But like the purchasing power, I don't even want to call it the US dollar value of Bitcoin, but the purchasing power of Bitcoin is going to fluctuate, of course. And so, you know, if all the markets crash, I mean, it's not going to be good for people. You know, the financial markets crash as far as the stock markets, equity markets, bond markets, real estate markets. I mean, we're still holding in Bitcoin, but one, if we were on a deserted island with no phone and no food and no water, no boat, and I had $1 billion of cash, $1 billion of gold and a 100 Bitcoin, none of them are worth anything to me because I need to be able to buy goods and services with them, even with the Bitcoin. And so we do have to kind of think about it in that perspective. But I think as Bitcoiners, the way that we look at it is like Bitcoin is kind of that ark, like Noah's ark, that we can go into. And when the storm settles back down, then we can reemerge and we can rebuild.
So,
Mark, you were telling us a story before you came on air that I wanted to just dip into here, if you wouldn't mind. Because I think, looking at you, you know, you've got a whole ton of subscribers on YouTube. I think you've got like 300,000 or 400,000 people that subscribe to your YouTube channel. you're obviously really successful as a business exec, and you're doing really well getting your message out there with your syndication. And that to me is kind of, you know, evidence of mainstream success. But like you said to us earlier, you know, you're talking about this, the point that we're at now being the battle for humanity. Mm-hmm. And I see what you're saying as being, you're coming from a position of being super red-pilled, right? And right. So there's a little bit of a paradox there, in that you've got mainstream success, but you're very much deep down the rabbit hole, and you've clearly knocked your head against the side of that rabbit hole quite a few times, and got very near to the bottom. So I want to know about how you've dealt with the fear of kind of coming through that, because I don't think, this is my assumption, that coming from that background that you've had, it's been necessarily easy to speak out and to, you know, tell the truth in the way that you are doing. So I think it's worth you just talking about how you kind of got doxed to begin with. And also, if you could talk about how you've got through that fear, because, you know, the way that I see it, fear is a prison that we build with our own minds. And certainly for me, even though I'm a NIM, speaking out has been one of the most liberating things that I've ever done. And I kind of really fucking wish I'd done it earlier.
Yeah.
So how's that been for you?
So the story that we were talking about offline that I can just tell briefly is I got my start in on the internet. Like I said, really 99, I was trying to launch a dot-com business that I thought I was going to get super rich off of. It was like a rewards-based shot e-commerce kind of thing. And if I was like a month or two too late, and then the dot-com thing happened, I lost my money. And then I started e-commerce business 2001. So I've been online for a long time. The story is that about 2007, 2008, I was doing lead generation. So I was working for mortgage companies or debt companies or whatever, and I would set them up a Google pay-per-click campaign and drive leads to like a landing page, right, for them. And I had a bunch of different clients, and I was doing some leads for this attorney group. And somebody wasn't happy with, you know, whatever their case with this law firm or whatever. They had paid them, I don't know, $1,700 or whatever for a down payment. And they weren't happy. The law firm agreed to give them their money back, but the guy was just like pissed off at the world or whatever the case was. It was after the 2008 crash. Everybody was pretty unhappy. And, you know, he just came after everybody, anybody he could find associated with this law firm, and just basically started just, you know, filing, just littered the internet basically with bad stuff, just a smear campaign. And he found out that I was marketing because one of the websites happened to be associated with my name. And then he did like a who is and found all the other domain names that I own, because I was an internet guy. So all these domains, and he typed up this letter about, you know, Mark is this bad guy and he works for these bad companies and he does these bad things and whatever. And then he just took that and just copy pasted it all across the internet to all these, you know, whatever scam sites and whatever it was. And it was devastating. It was like, I wanted to crawl under a rock and just die. It was like, I had friends and family like seeing this and like asking me about it, you know? And like, I had to like defend it one by one by one by one. And it was just like, it was just overwhelming for me. And there was really nothing I could do to like get it taken down or anything. And so at that point, it wasn't a NIM. I basically just went hidden. And I didn't get off the internet. But from that point forward, I was completely anonymous. All my name, you know, all my websites were now under privacy. Everything I did publicly was under alias names and all those types of things. Not because I was doing anything nefarious, but I wasn't doing anything nefarious in the first place. But like, anybody can accuse you of anything and can say anything. And so it was devastating. That was just my own personal thing I dealt with, and it crushed me. I never wanted to be known for anything. I liked the internet because I could set up these campaigns and I can go snowboarding and I can go on surf trips and I can go do whatever I want. Nobody knew about me. And I enjoyed that. That was good. In 2018, my business partner at the time, I got full confession to make, guys. I spent a better part of 4 years writing a cryptocurrency research newsletter. During that time, I personally researched and published like over 1,000 pages of research on all the different cryptocurrency projects that were out there. So after getting into Bitcoin in 2015, I realized like, dang, we finally have a tool that we can win. And I should tell this part of the story. So I bought Bitcoin in 2015. I was super disillusioned with the entire political system and financial system after getting wiped out in 2018. Give me one second.
You mean 2008?
2013.
2018, you were doing pretty good, I imagine.
Sorry. So I got, after 2008, I got disillusioned with all that. The political system after 2012, over that. And I remember I was subscribed to this newsletter, Sovereign Man, and it started forming this worldview that I wouldn't put all my money in one stock. So why would I have all my life in one country? Why wouldn't I have multiple flags? Why couldn't I have a bank account in Hong Kong or Panama or Singapore? And so in 2015, I was in the process of setting up a bank account in Panama to get residency and then citizenship. And I took another look at Bitcoin and I said, wait a minute, this is the same thing. I can just get my money out of the bank. Very easy. So I bought Bitcoin. And after going down the rabbit hole a little bit, I was like, wait a minute. Like, we have a tool that we can win. Like, now we actually have hope. I got to tell everybody in the world. And so I started telling everybody in the world. But then I got caught up in the crypto thing. And then it was like, maybe it is blockchain is the actual real thing. It's not Bitcoin. Bitcoin's old. It's blockchain. And I admit, you know, I went down that rabbit hole for a number of years. After researching and writing and publishing over 1,000 pages of research on every crypto project out there during that period, I decided that it was all a bunch of smoke and mirrors. And I just wanted to focus on Bitcoin, which is why I'm back here. But back to your point, like, how did I get past that point of hurt? Well, I was writing this cryptocurrency newsletter. They banned, if you remember, at the end of 2017, Facebook and Google banned all cryptocurrency advertising.
Yeah.
So what can I do? And my business partner at the time in this crypto business, he started a YouTube channel and he started doing his technical analysis on the YouTube channel. And he said, hey, Mark, you got to come and do a video with me. And I'm like, no, I don't. I'm anonymous. I don't want anyone to know who I am. And he's like, dude, you're my business partner. Like, we were making a lot of money at the time. He's like, you got to do a video with me. So I did. And I just sat next to him and we kind of live streamed together. And like, it was kind of fun. And people seemed to kind of like it. And I kept doing it for a while. And after a while, he's like, all right, dude, you got to get off my channel. Like, go start your own channel. I'm like, I don't want a channel. Like, I never wanted to be on it in the first place. He's like, start your own channel. So I did. But that's kind of my story. But I guess to the question of like, how did I get past like that scare, that hurt? And it was bad. I mean, it really messed me up. But I think, you know, my grandfather is a decorated World War II vet, Purple Heart recipient. My father flew jets in Vietnam. I when I was born, my dad was still in the Air Force. I grew up in that kind of military family, and I just naturally assumed I was going to go to war one day. That was just kind of my life. I grew up, you know, from a military family. And I didn't. Right. Well, I didn't, but I look at this now as my war. I know for people that have really been to war, that may sound wrong, and I apologize if it does, but like, my grandfather fought in World War II. People stormed the beaches of Normandy and saw their friends dying left and right of them, and they continued to charge forward. And I'm going to be scared to say what I think? Mm-hmm. I can never do that.
Yeah, exactly.
I can exactly. never do that. And so
it's the easiest fucking war any of us will ever fight.
World War II?
I'm sure that any of us will ever fight today. Now.
Yeah.
Greg, you potato.
You're a potato.
So, you know, we're in a very easy, convenient war. But I'm sure that if there was a beach to go and fight on, you'd go and fight on it. I would go and fight on it. But this is our beach, right? It's a digital beach that we're on. And we're stepping up and speaking our minds. But this is the thing, right? I mean, you've got a digital background, Mark. It's not like this is just, you know, we post stuff, we broadcast stuff, we send this stuff out into the digital realm, thinking that it's never going to be picked up by any of our adversaries and used against us. We know full well that it could be, right? But we're still doing it.
Yeah.
So...
Just like the beach on Normandy. I mean, I know my neighbor's going to get killed and I might, and I'm just going to have to continue to do that. I think, you know, I respect everybody's right to choose, you know, how much exposure they want to take. The way I look at it is like, don't tell anybody you own Bitcoin. It's like, really? Like, we know who the Forbes richest people in the world are. Like, I'm nowhere near that list. I'm nowhere near a Tucker Carlson or a Alex Jones. Like no matter how big I get, I'm not a Joe Rogan. So I don't know. I'm not anywhere close to the richest people. I'm nowhere near the biggest, you know, information people. So maybe I kind of have a little bit of comfort in that perspective, as far as like, you know, from an adversarial perspective. As far as other people not liking me and smearing my name, I've put out so much information and I've built so much goodwill in the world at this point that if a few bad people want to talk crap about me, like go for it, you know?
Well, if you like, we're actually, we're involved with a company that specializes in OPSEC. It's a company called SusCorp. They run mine and Sean's OPSEC. So like nobody knows who we are, what our faces look like, and it's all because of these guys. I'd be happy to get you set up with them.
It hasn't worked real well.
What are you talking about?
What? No one knows our names.
Yeah, nobody knows who we are.
They exist even less than the meme factory.
SusCorp has a special package that will hold two of your three keys.
That's a good deal.
Or three of five, you know, whatever setup you want.
You know, that ship has kind of sailed for me, unfortunately, at this point. But you know, I'm at the point, you know, I get asked all the time, you know, I went on the Monero talk and debated those guys with Bitcoin, and you know, people always ask, you know, a lot of people are pushing, you have to buy your Bitcoin, stack your Bitcoin, you know, KYC free and this and that. And my approach is, come and take it. You want to go to the Supreme Court? I'll be the guy. Like, you want me to like be the figurehead? I guess at this point, that's where I'm going to be. It's too late for me. Like I said, I'm small potatoes, so I don't expect me to be the martyr. But I guess that's just kind of my point of view at this point.
Yeah. Well, there's absolutely tons and tons of people. And I think any of us could only hope to achieve the kinds of success that some of the bigger names out there could be. But certainly in our realm, Mark, you've struck out and made a massive success of what you're doing. And it takes balls to do that, mate. So thanks for doing it. Good on you.
Just to clarify, since he's European, when he says tons, he's talking about metric tons.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for clarifying that.
Double N, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now you're a surfer, right? All right. So you see all kinds of aquatic life whenever you're out there.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think a surfer is?
They get on the boat, and then they ride the wind.
A windsurfer.
It's a windsurfer, right? All right. So. One of the questions we got hit with on the thread was, and this is the best one I could find. If you were faced with the choice of fighting like 30 otters or a leopard seal, which way would you rather go?
I would say probably the 30 otters.
I mean, they're nasty.
I mean, I've seen plenty of otters in the water. They haven't been too nasty. I've swam with seals and they're big and they got big teeth. So yeah, I don't know.
There are like 30 of them.
Yeah. So I guess one seal then. I don't know. Yeah. Probably one seal.
You do like nose punch. What do you think?
You know, if I, so where I'm at in Southern California, we have a lot of great whites. They're very common. We see them in the water quite often. You know, routinely the helicopters fly over and spot them and they'll close beaches down. So I haven't ever come face to face with one, but we've seen, you know, you see them. And it's something I've thought a lot about. That's why I'm saying that. I think if I was diving, so I do a lot of diving, free diving. If I was down in the water with it and you could see it face to face, I think you have a pretty good chance of fending it off.
A shark.
So on a seal, I've been swimming and diving with seals a lot, quite frequently. So They're not very aggressive, but yeah, I guess I would just punch it right in the nose. That'd probably be the best bet.
Okay. We won't tell PETA.
Well, if I was being attacked, you know.
Defense. Right. Yeah. Self defense.
Self defense.
All right. So the one of the more important parts of this podcast is RD has an important question that we make sure you get the chance to ask every live stream. I know we're getting to the end of the show, and I want to make sure we're respectful of your time. It looks like he's in Chicago right now.
Yeah, man.
What?
Hey, Mark. Yeah, this is the important part of the podcast with all the important questions coming in now. So
what? Get on with it.
That's Maller's closet, isn't it?
It is, man. Yeah.
Do I need to get like a pen and paper and write these down? Or
you might.
Mm-hmm.
I know a foundation.
I've got my notes here. Okay, Mark. If the meme factory did exist, and we all know it doesn't, who would you like? Who would you retweet? And who would you mute?
Are you going to give me a list?
We're all right here.
a list. Well, shoot. Man, you're gonna make me choose favorites here. Dang.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess I'm gonna probably have to pick Greg.
For what?
Well, for the memes.
No. Are you liking, retweeting, or muting me?
Oh, I would say. Oh, do I have to do one for each one of you?
No. You just gotta pick one. Oh. One for each of those three.
I would say to retweet.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Who?
I like the memes.
Who are you muting?
You can mute me.
And why is it?
I have
Pedro?
Seals.
Okay, I'll mute Yellow since he's sacrificed himself up.
All right. Who are you liking?
I guess RD.
Yes.
I think that's the first like RD's got.
I got a finally got one.
I gotta retweet the memes because, as you heard, I think one of you guys quoted me is like, you know, we got memes and yes. We got Bitcoin, and they got nothing, right? And so, like, I said that, and it's kind of funny, but like, that's literally how I think we win, right? The war is not. I don't think the war will be fought over guns and weapons. It's going to be fought over information and money. And if you look back at how like the USSR fell, or how socialism was fended off in other countries, a lot of it was done through memes, like through propaganda, but you know, through their war posters, et cetera. A lot of it was done with kind of humor and criticism. And so the humor, it plays a huge piece in topping totalitarian governments throughout history. And so I interviewed JP Sears the other day, and we talked about this. And you know, the humor only works if there's truth in it. And so you find something of truth, the humor brings down the hate. You can't have a joy and hate in your heart at the same time. So it kind of brings that down. You think rationally, and then it pokes fun at the enemy. And so while it's funny, it's actually super effective. So it's information and money. And we have memes. And memes are humor that poke fun, that have reality in them. And they're super effective. And we have Bitcoin, right? We have both. And when I said they have nothing, like the left can't meme. Like we've seen their attempts at memeing, they don't work, and then they got dollars, so that doesn't work either.
I watched that episode with Sears. That he was really insightful. I didn't expect him to be that interesting to listen to. He's also jacked.
Yeah, he is.
It's like the
Did you see the EU, the European Commission published a paper on Europa.eu, and the title was "It's Not Funny Anymore. Far Right Extremists Are Using Humor to Poke Fun at Us and Discredit Us." Literally, it's an entire there's an 18-page paper that, and they've included memes in it as well. I've got to check this actually. That there's ones that you'll definitely recognise. I'm looking at it now. It's hilarious. So, yeah, we need to post this link. I'm going to tweet it, actually.
Yeah, tweet but it out.
They're terrified. They've got nothing. They've literally got nothing.
Or wasn't there like an article that was like, the dollar is not a meme or something like the money go printer money printer go burr isn't a meme or something. I can't remember what it was exactly. And then it just meme harder.
Cry harder.
Yeah. But it's super effective. You know, another thing is they've lost their ability to laugh at themselves. But I say we keep doing it.
Now while you're here with us, any questions you have for any members of the Meme Factory? Or anything you want to leave our audience
I'd
with?
I'd like to ask more official, you know, questions of the Meme Factory, but I heard the Meme Factory doesn't exist.
Nope.
So, this is true.
Any answers you get are hearsay.
No, but I love what you guys are doing. Keep pumping them out. It's needed. It's the ammo for the war.
Okay.
You guys are the munition experts.
All right. Is there anything you're working on, or anything you want to tell anybody who's watching that where they can find you, what you have? When's the Spetsky book coming out that you worked with?
He's probably not going to like me talking about it, but I haven't been able to keep it quiet. We took the Communist Manifesto and we rewrote it.
Wow.
And we're calling it the Uncommunist Manifesto.
Original.
Okay. Yeah. Because we basically kept the same book and we kept the same structure, the same order, the same length, and we just tried to flip it. And we hope, because the Communist Manifesto is like 8,000 words. I mean, an average person should read that in 45 minutes or an hour. It's an easy read. And so we're hoping that we can kind of keep that same structure, keep it about an hour of reading or less. Everybody can read it, and hoping that it can really flip the script on this, and maybe it can go super viral. Well, that's kind of what we're hoping for. So we're going to start, we just finished it editing. I think he finished editing it today. We're going to try to, I think we may launch. Well, I don't want to give too much away. We're going to have them ready before the Bitcoin conference. Let's just say that.
All right. Nice. So you'll be signing those books. I'll be signing potatoes. It'll be like we're brothers.
Yeah, there we go. So, so I'll be speaking at the Bitcoin conference. I'm super excited about that. We'll be getting those books ready for that. And other than that, I make a couple of videos a week on my YouTube channel, Mark Moss. I have the podcast on the iHeart Network, so you can just search Mark Moss podcast and find that. And catch me on a podcast coming near you.
All right, Mark.
Nice.
Thanks for your time, man. Everybody who showed up tonight. Thank you. Check out the show notes. You'll be able to find us, the merch store. You'll be able to find Mark and his Twitter feed and his webpage down there. Thanks for coming.
Appreciate your time, Mark. Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mike.
a singer in a smoky room. I smell of wine and cheap perfume. For a smile they can share the